Brother Richard has prepared a handout, which I trust each of you have. And Brother Richard will now give us his discourse on our search for truth.
I'm going to have to get trifocals, I guess. It's the practice of many of the brethren when they give discourses, particularly late in a convention, to acknowledge some of the previous speakers who have given thoughts along the same line that they are giving. And as Brother David opened the convention, and I took some notes on what he had to say because parallel some of the thoughts that I was going to make, and I wanted to acknowledge that. Then Brother Paul did the same thing, and then all day Saturday, every speaker was saying something that I was intending to say. So I'm not going to acknowledge all the previous thoughts that have been presented. So much of what I am going to say, you have already heard at this convention. It's just perhaps put in a little different package. I believe all of us here today share a common goal. That's the truth. We are gathered here because it is here we will hear words of truth. Truth of the Bible, truth of God's gracious character, the truth of the marvelous plan of salvation. So it is in the spirit of this search for truth that I present my thoughts today. Such a search must of necessity be a cooperative effort. God has arranged the development of His new creation, so intercourse is essential. No, make that mandatory. As the Apostle Paul indicated to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 12, "But now are there many members, yet but one body. And the eye cannot say unto the hand, I have no need of thee, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you." Our grand search for truth must involve others. It cannot be a solitary pursuit. The fundamental law underlying all of God's work is love. And love has meaning only when others are involved. So I present my thoughts, therefore, as only one part, one small part, of this cooperative effort to search out and learn the truth. What I say is not monologue. It is but one part of the great dialogue in which we all must take part. There is a virus in the world from which more and more brethren seem to suffer. A contagion that greatly inhibits the search for truth. For lack of a commonly accepted name, I will call it the messenger syndrome. And under this name, I would include two closely related ailments. One is the counterpart of the other, involving contrary symptoms. The first is as pervasive as the common cold. Much of the world has been afflicted at one time or another. It may be called shoot the messenger. When a truth is brought forth not to our liking, a truth we cannot easily refute, our response oft time is to shoot the messenger. The Bible shows that fallen humanity has suffered from this disorder for thousands of years. Israel killed the prophets God sent to them because they did not want to hear the message. Later, they even killed the Son of God. Today, here in the United States, we see a particularly viral form of this disorder in the negative political campaigns that have become so commonplace. Not able to challenge the arguments of an opponent, an attack is made on his character. The issues, the truth, are seldom addressed. So whatever form this disorder takes, the truth suffers. Shoot the messenger always results in the truth being a victim. The second disorder under the messenger syndrome is idolize the messenger. This too has a long history. God buried the body of Moses following his death so the Jews would not be stricken by this malady. In the days of the apostles, the people of Lystra attempted to idolize Paul and Barnabas. In modern times, we have had Hitler, along with many others. Here in the United States, this disorder has been recently manifested by celebrity advertising. But whatever form it takes, idolize the messenger, trivializes the truth. Knowing of these afflictions and our susceptibility to them, the Lord has given us a responsibility. Epistle Jude, verse 3. Beloved, it is needful for me to write unto you and exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. This is no small assignment. It is a task that will not end until God turns to the people a pure language. The Apostle John explained in Revelation chapter 12, verse 9, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world." For 6,000 years, Satan has been busy deceiving the world, trying to disrupt God's plan and corrupt his truth. He has devised many successful methods. As Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians, "But if our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost, in whom the God of this world hath blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them." Not only has the vast majority of the human race been deceived, they have been apt students of Satan's methods. Many have joined in with their own deceptions. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 13, "But evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived." In fact, these methods have become so commonplace, it becomes almost natural to turn to their use. As a consequence, in our search for truth, we must be ever on the alert, ever watchful for these snares. Because they have become so commonplace, many today use their methods unintentionally. It is such a natural thing to do. They are unaware they are using deceptive methods. For example, when is the last time you saw a price on something given in round dollars? It's always $2.99, $6.95, $99.50. I'm sure today when people put those prices, they're not consciously thinking that they're trying to deceive, but it is a deceptive practice. When was the last time you heard a little white lie? The temptation is always there to use these methods. It is so easy to do. God's arrangement for the cooperative development of the new creation is our only protection. Only by a continuous dialogue can we overcome the messenger syndrome and avoid all the deceptions that threaten our search for truth. One method God has used to protect the truth from Satan's wiles was vividly portrayed by Jesus in Luke chapter 12, verses 51 and 52. Luke 12, 51 and 52. Suppose ye that I am come to give peace on earth. This is another one of those texts that has been covered this weekend. I tell you, nay, but rather division. For from henceforth there shall be five in one house divided, three against two, and two against three. This principle of division, separation, has a long history in God's relationship with His creation. In the beginning, in the first creative day, God divided the light from the darkness. This principle carried over in God's relationship with His chosen people. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show you. Separation was paramount in God's demands on Israel. Leviticus 20, verse 26, and ye shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have severed you from other people, that ye should be mine. Separation was the essence of the Nazarite vow. Numbers 6, verses 1 and 2. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord. In the next few verses, the requirements of that separation are laid out. Then in verse 8, all the days of his separation he is holy unto the Lord. Separation in Israel even carried over to the animals and plants. Leviticus 19:19. Ye shall keep my statutes. Thou shalt not let thy cattle gender with a diverse kind. Thou shalt not sow thy field with a mingled seed. Neither shall a garment mingled of linen and woolen come upon thee. Even in the clothes they wore, separation was demanded by God. Yes, and even in the way they were to work. Deuteronomy 22, verse 10. Thou shalt not plow with an ox and an ass together. This last text was no doubt the basis for Paul's admonition to the Corinthians not to be unequally yoked, thus showing God's principle of separation carried over to the church. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion hath light with darkness? Note how Paul not only reached back to the law, but back to day one of creation. Jesus indicated separation would be a natural consequence of following him. Luke 6, verse 22. Blessed are ye when men shall hate you, and when they shall separate you from their company, and shall reproach you, and cast out your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. At the end of his ministry, Jesus explained to his disciples, again another text that has been touched on, "I tell you, in that night there shall be two men in one bed. The one shall be taken, and the other shall be left. Two women shall be grinding together. The one shall be taken, the other left." These words confused the disciples. So they asked Jesus where the separated ones were taken. His answer, though difficult to understand, is important. "Wheresoever the body is, thither will the eagles be gathered together." It must be noted that Jesus did not use the plural. There is only one body, one carcass, as Matthew recorded it, one serving of meat, one gathering of the eagles. We can see from this brief review the principle of separation as applied in all of God's relationships. And in our search for truth, in our consecrated walk, we will be separated. As a people of God, the church must be separate, just as was the nation of Israel. Now, up to this point, we have discussed general aspects of our search for truth. Now, I would like to turn to two specific events that have occurred in the past year within our fellowship that have significant impact on our search. The first is the mailing of an open letter to Bible students. I'm sure many of you received it. This open letter is an excellent example of both aspects of the messenger syndrome. The writers rightly diagnosed the idolized the messenger disorder that has afflicted a significant number of brethren. But what remedy do they prescribe? They advise us to shoot the messenger. As we have seen, this is not a remedy. It too is an affliction. Shoot the messenger and idolize the messenger are two sides of the one messenger syndrome coin. Neither are helpful to our search for truth. And though I am concerned by the doctrinal errors in this open letter, I am more concerned by the reaction of some brethren to it. I have by no means talked to a sufficient number of brethren to have a sample large enough to be statistically significant. So I can't give you, I'm accurate within plus or minus so many percent. However, with those to whom I have talked, I have found two reactions that concern me. First, after reading the opening paragraphs and understanding its purpose, they trash it without further consideration. And second, agreeing with the diagnosis that many brethren are seriously ill with the idolized the messenger virus, they accept the other assertions in the letter with little questioning. Neither of these reactions are healthy. Neither give any support to our search for truth. Both turn away from the requirement God has given us. We must earnestly contend for the truth. Having said that, I do want to address a couple of the issues raised in the letter. On page 3, a question is asked. Are there two gospels? Is there one for Gentiles and one for Jews? Though no direct answer is given in the letter, there is a strong implication. The answer should be, no, there is only one. Brethren, the Apostle Paul addressed this question over 1,900 years ago Romans 11, verse 25. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part is happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Now verse 28. As concerning the gospel, they are enemies for your sakes. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sakes. The gospel, the good news for the church, is not for Israel as a nation. Concerning the gospel, they are enemies. Is there a good news, a gospel, for Israel? Most certainly. Are there two gospels? Yes. Acts 15, verses 13 through 17. And after they had held their peace, James answered, saying, Men and brethren, hearken unto me. Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. And to this agree the words of the prophets, as it is written, after this refers back to the word first in verse 14, after first visiting the Gentiles to take out a people, after this the Lord will do such and so. Verse 16, after this I will return and I will build again the tabernacle of David, which is fallen down. And I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord. Yes, there are two gospels, two elections, two peoples of God. After visiting the Gentiles, God will build again the tabernacle or tent of David. He has a work for the house of David, the people of Israel. A work here on earth, a work to restore the whole of the human race to the pristine condition they enjoyed in the Garden of Eden. Ezekiel 36. 33 through 36. Another text that you have heard this weekend. A prophecy directed to the nation of Israel. Thus saith the Lord God, in the day that I shall have cleansed you, Israel, from all your iniquities, I will also cause you to dwell in the cities, and the waste shall be builded, and the desolate land shall be tilled, whereas it lay desolate in the sight of all that pass by. And they shall say, This land that was desolate is become like the Garden of Eden. And the waste and desolate and ruined cities are become fenced and are inhabited. And then the heathen that are left round about you, Israel, shall know that I, the Lord, build the ruined places and plant that was desolate. I, the Lord, have spoken it, and I will do it. What is the purpose for God doing this for Israel? Verses 37, 38. I will increase them, Israel, with men, the world, like a flock, as the holy flock, as the flock of Jerusalem in her solemn feast. So shall the waste cities be filled with flocks of men. And they shall know that I am the Lord. Two gospels. Yes. They are two salvations in God's great plan of deliverance. As many of you here know, Sister Shirley and I have actively supported the ministry of comfort to the Jews that some of our brethren have initiated. So I must admit, I take the attack on that ministry in the open letter very personal. Though the claim is made that no personal offense is meant, I find that difficult to accept in light of the strong words used. I quote from page 4. This ministry, referring to the ministry of comfort, mocks New Testament teaching. Also, the mockery this ministry makes of Jesus Christ. When I wrote this talk, I did not know who the writers of this open letter were. I have just learned at this convention possible names. But when I prepared the talk, I said, I'm thankful I do not know who the writers are, because this helps me resist falling prey to shoot the messenger virus. In response, let me make just one point. If the writers of the open letter feel there is a need for a ministry to preach Jesus to Jews, they are certainly free to so do. I find it incredible that they should present an argument as if it's an either-or situation, as if there can only be one ministry, either a ministry of comfort or a ministry of conversion. I know no one associated with the ministry of comfort that takes such a position. The Apostle John raised a similar issue with Jesus in Luke chapter 9, verse 49. And John answered and asked, Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and we forbade him, because he followed not with us. Jesus answered, Forbid him not. Those who feel a ministry of conversion is needed are free to pursue it with all dispatch. Those who feel a ministry of comfort is God's will for them should have the same liberty. And I would ask that words like mockery of Jesus Christ, when describing such a ministry, be firmly supported by Scripture. In the letter, I found no such support. Such words, when not fully supported, do not encourage dialogue, and they hinder our search for truth. Another issue raised by the open letter is that of progress. On page 6, in bold type, the question is asked, why has the Bible student movement made so little progress in the last 100 years? At first, I was not sure what was meant by progress. A couple of pages later, however, it is declared the movement is nearing extinction. I wish they'd heard Brother Joe's report last night. Then, on the next page, the issue of growth in numbers is raised. Based on these subsequent statements, I must assume progress has reference to growth in numbers. To support their concern, the writers compare the attendance of 360 at the First National Convention to 600 at the last. I found it interesting. They failed to mention the Polish conventions, where I understand the numbers can be as high as 2,000. In fact, I found the whole of the letter to be myopic, no, even chauvinistic. There's little question the writers were Americans. Anyone not familiar with our fellowship would, after reading this letter, have the idea that God's great work, His new creation, was confined to the borders of the United States of America. Absolutely no mention is made of the brethren in Europe, Africa, India, Australia, Japan, South America, No mention is made of the wonderful international conventions that have been attended by hundreds of brethren for over a decade and a half. No mention is made of the work that has gone on in South America, Africa, and Japan for the last two decades. Brethren, God's new creation, His development of a divine family, is not limited to the United States of America. In fact, I have a very specific question for the writers of this open letter. If you are so concerned about progress, where is your support for the Bible Student Committee for Africa? How many trips have you made to Nigeria to assist our dear brethren there? If you are truly interested in growth, Nigeria is an area crying for attention. I find it singular that such an issue would be raised in the first place. Numbers never have been and never will be part of God's work in developing His new creation. It is not a popularity contest. This great work of the Creator has been and continues to be a mystery, an enigma to the world. It is not God's purpose to convert the whole of fallen humanity at this time. As James declared, God is taking out of the Gentiles a people for His name. Jesus identified this people as a little flock, as has been mentioned at this convention. In Matthew 7, verse 14, He declared, "Straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth to life, and few there be that find it." This concept of a narrow way, which only a few can find, bothered one of Jesus' disciples. He questioned Jesus about it. Luke 13, verses 23 and 24. "Then said one unto Him, Lord, are there few that be saved? And He," that is Jesus, "said unto them, Strive to enter in at the strait gate, for many, I say unto you, will seek to enter in, and shall not be able." If for some reason the work of the new creation should start making progress, if it should start growing in numbers, that would be a sign to me that it was not God's work. Now, do not misunderstand me. I am not saying small numbers are proof that a particular movement is God's handiwork. What I am saying is that large numbers would be proof that it is not. Unlike the writers of the open letter, my prayer is that the new creation here on earth passes into extinction very soon. The sooner, the better, for then the great work of restoring the world can begin. There are many other issues associated with the open letter that could be discussed, but there is another happening this past year among the brethren I want to address. So to bring my thoughts on the open letter to a close, let me say I find it to be of little help. Though it called attention to the movement's affliction of idolize the messenger, its remedy of shoot the messenger is of no value. Instead of encouraging the open dialogue so greatly needed, its inflammatory words like mockery, irrational fanaticism, only turn brethren away. Because of such a negative reaction, the letter does present a difficulty. Brethren should not just trash it, neither should they just accept its assertions. We must earnestly contend for the truth. And though there is nothing directly stated, I sense from the letter a lack of understanding of God's principle of separation. Instead, I got the feeling the writers felt as Israel must have felt when they greatly desired to be like other nations. They did not want to be different. They did not want to be separate. I pray that is not the heart's desire, the writers of the open letter. Again, this is something that has been alluded to at this convention. Recently, there have been a number of brethren who have concluded there is something missing in their Christian walk. Failing to find help within the fellowship, they have turned to various institutions within Christendom. It is not an isolated event in just one or two ecclesias, but has been experienced across the country, coast to coast. I do not believe this is a wise choice on these brethren's part. I would liken such a course to that of a person who can see going to a blind person and asking for a description of a sunrise. But whatever the reason may be, it is not their action I want to discuss. I would like to take the remaining minutes to reflect on the responsibility of the rest of us in this matter and the import to our search for truth. I believe the rest of us have failed these brethren. I believe the rest of us have a responsibility in this. I believe God expects each of us to be our brother's keeper. Having said that, it's necessary that I explain. For about two decades now, many ecclesias in the United States have stopped using Volume 2 of the Studies in the Scriptures, the volume entitled The Time Is at Hand. I am aware of some of the reasons this has been so. Unfortunately, there is one topic in that volume that is critical to the present issue. Study 9, the man of sin. I believe a general lack of attention to this topic has resulted in a loss of appreciation of the vast gulf that separates God's little flock from Christendom. Brethren, let me state my belief in clear and simple terms. The God worshipped by Christendom is not the God you and I worship. The God of Abraham, the God of Israel, the God of the Bible. Their God is more foreign to our God than is Allah, the God of Islam. It is my fervent belief no one can or will be resurrected a divine being who believes in and worships the God of Christendom, a God of wrath, three gods in one. The biblical viewpoint of Christendom is stated in the book of Revelation in distinct and unmistakable terms. I don't need to read the charges brought against the great harlot Babylon. You have read them many times. But I am sure there are some who would argue that those condemning words do not apply to the little church down on the corner. The people there are so devout, so sincere, so loving, such good, God-fearing Christians. My answer is that I find no scripture that would exclude that church from the condemnation. There are many mosques in this world, where the people are just as devout, just as sincere, just as loving. And I am sure during Jesus' day there was many a synagogue in Israel where the people were just as devout, just as sincere, just as loving. Keep in mind, there was only a small handful of Jews involved in the death of Jesus. Yet the whole nation, faithful and unfaithful, were scattered to the four winds. In his great prophecy, Jesus stated, "For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." For over 1900 years, this has been dramatically fulfilled. Century after century, Christendom has taken the name of Christ. They have preached Jesus is the Christ, and they have deceived many. Yes, they declare Jesus is Christ, but they also teach a God of wrath, an egocentric salvation, as has already been brought out at the convention, along with many other anti-biblical doctrines. Christendom is the workmanship of Satan, the great deceiver, just as are the other false religions in this world. The church on the corner is just as much his work as the Pope sitting in the Vatican. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 17 through 19. "These are wells without water, clouds that are carried with a tempest, to whom the midst of darkness is reserved forever. For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same he is brought in bondage." The clean must escape from those who live in error. Those who live in error promise liberty, but they themselves are servants of corruption. These words apply to Christendom, brethren. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus set out a fundamental principle, Matthew 6, verse 24. "No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other." You've heard this also this weekend. We cannot worship two gods. Challenge Joshua gave to Israel is just as valid today as when he uttered it so many centuries ago. "Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. And if it seem evil unto you to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Brethren, God has decreed that his people are to be separate and are to worship no other gods. It is my belief we do not adequately teach this in our ecclesias. And as Paul admonished the Corinthians, "Be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion hath light with darkness?" Since the first day of creation, God has decreed that light is to be separated from darkness. Paul continued, "Wherefore come out from among them and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you." Just as Israel had to separate herself from Egypt to become a people of God, so the followers of Jesus must separate themselves. Come out of her, my people. Now, I would challenge you here today to make this a topic for serious study in your ecclesias. I know the needs of those who turn to Christendom are great. I know many times they get little help or sympathy from the brethren. But having said that, let me repeat. In His wisdom, God has decreed we are to be separate. And those of us here do not have a responsibility to follow these prodigal sons to the far country. But if they find the husk of the swine not to their liking, we must welcome them home, just as did the gracious father of the parable. We must run to meet them with open arms, with only love in our hearts, and with no incriminating words. Brethren, we are different. With eyes that see and ears that hear, we have little in common with the blind and deaf in Christendom. It is only if we separate ourselves and associate with those to whom God has given eyes and ears that we can complete our walk successfully. It is a cooperative effort. We cannot do without each other. The eagles gather where the carcass is. And in the coming year, I am sure we will have more surprises, experiences. Discord and enmity will continue in our fellowship. But let us remember Paul's words. For there must be also heresies or schisms among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest among you. Let us watch our hearts, that we may be of those who are approved. It is my prayer, and our study today will be of a help to you in that endeavor, and will assist you in your continuing search for truth. And may the Lord add His blessing.
And in the time of harvest, He shall gather out of His kingdom all those that offend and do iniquity, and then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Thank you, Brother Richard, for encouraging us to be Berean Bible students. May the Lord help us, guide us, keep us, direct us. I'd like to close with the hymn Brother Richard has suggested, hymn number 306, and Brother Richard will close with prayer for us. Brother Joe, will lead us singing, please.
Lord, speak and let
Our most gracious Heavenly Father, we thank Thee again for this privilege of coming together. We ask for Thy continued guidance and overruling. We ask particularly that You overrule anything that may have been said amiss. Be with us now in the continuing activities of this day, our fellowship that follows. We ask it all in the name of Thy Son, Christ Jesus.
To tell the story of unseen things above, of Jesus and His glory, of Jesus and His love. I love to tell the story because I know it's true. It satisfies my longing as nothing else can do. I love to tell the story. Will be my theme. Jesus and His.